Hi.
Hello, everyone. I'm Leslie Cornwell, certified nurse midwife with Empowering Midwifery Education. I have Janet Spinner here with me. It's so fun how the universe just kind of brings things. She thought she was talking to a student, didn't realize that she signed up for an interview, but just a little bit before I hit record, I was beyond like, she's got a very impressive story. So, Janet, thank you for joining me today.
Hi, I'm glad to speak with you and to share with you some of my journey into nurse midwifery. I lived on the farm during my younger adult years and was part of their health crew there and would take care of things like pneumonias and flus and lacerations and just the general health care well-being of the families. I would go to women's homes, especially if we were concerned about the well-being of the children in that home, and teach mothers how to do things like, how do you wash your child? How do you keep your clothes clean? Because not everybody that came from the farm was from the same kind of socioeconomic background. And we took care of each other, and we all learned. On the farm, there were community meetings that happened every Sunday. It was after a service with Stephen Gaskin and Ina May. It was a sunrise service and with an om afterwards. And we all got to know each other there, as well as in the community. There were 1,500 people living there at its height. Now it's down to about 500 people, but it's in Summertown, Tennessee. A very rural area. The last time I was down there, I was impressed with how it had evolved because when I lived there initially, I lived in the woman's tent, and that was an old army tent. And there were 15 women living together there. We shared bunks and shared mattresses with each other. And when you became a couple, you got to live in your own small tent. And eventually, people were building houses and the like. But we all ate at a central kitchen. And eventually, it evolved past that. During those years, after my husband and I became a real couple and married, he and I went to a place called the Bronx Center, which was a spinoff of something called Plenty. Have you ever heard of Plenty? No. Plenty was the relief work project. And that project, there were projects in Guatemala. There was a project in Bangladesh. This was in the South Bronx. And I don't know whether you're familiar with the history of the South Bronx, but those were the years when the Bronx was literally burning. And there were a lot of fires happening a lot of the time. And the ambulance response time for things like a cardiac arrest or a gunshot wound were like 15 to 20 minutes. So there were several of us that were paramedics at the time. And we started up the what was called the Bronx Center. Initially, it was also a birthing center, which is how I ended up going there. I went there to have my baby and did indeed have my daughter in 1978 in the South Bronx. And the window was open. It was a warm winter day, very warm winter day for December. And we could hear ambulances and fire trucks going by and people talking below. And when I was pushing I remember well our neighbors, a bunch of women, were hanging in the window and cheering me on to push harder. To push
Oh,
harder.
well, just to think of going from living on the farm to going to living in the Bronx, like you're an adaptable woman. I
Know.
could just tell already to be, I mean, those are pretty extreme
Well,
settings. Yeah.
yeah, so the farm was a collective of, and the Bronx Center was a spin-off of that.
Yeah, that's true. So.
Right, so there was like 50 people living in this walk-up apartment building that we rehabbed. The earliest time that we were there, there was a crew of people that had to shovel dog excrement out of the basement, because it was inhabited by a bunch of wild dogs. And we had to put in the wiring, and we ended up getting to know some of the other squatters in the building, Nate and Margaret, or actually it was Nat and Margaret, and we did their electricity for them and thus became friends. It was quite an exciting time. They'd say there were about 50 of us there. Half of us were under the age of 5. So it was a young population, and we would take the kids down to the park as a crew. We'd have 3 adults and lots of little kids hanging on to us, and we would go down to Crotona Park and became very well embedded in that community in that fashion. The midwives and the healthcare providers in that center, we've manned something called Plenty Ambulance Service. Because, again, that was a time when there was a lot of gunshots and fires in the South Bronx, and we actually settled there to address that. I remember the one of the more exciting events was that I was there cleaning the house at that time. There were some gunshots down the road, down the hill from us. There wasn't anybody else there. And I think my husband was there as well. He was manning the radio service that we used to stay in touch with the other members of the collective. I ran down with a first aid kit. My husband came running after us, and we were working on splinting of this gentleman's fractured femur, which is a big deal, and doing the best we could, when all of a sudden a newly donated secondhand state-of-the-art ambulance drives up by to us to help with our ambulance folks, and we were able to take this person on to the hospital. It was just
Oh
totally
my
wonderful. Yeah, quite thrilling, quite thrilling. We had orange bomber jackets. That was our basically our uniform for the ambulance service. There was an article that was and it was where was it in the, I think it was in the Post. It was Yippee for the Hippies, and it went out, and we became very much a national phenomena. And at that point, we got lots and lots of donations, and the ambulance service really blasted off. So it's quite an exciting time.
Oh my goodness. I'm like, I just
Yeah.
think sometimes when I hear the stories of what people fought for midwifery or the challenges when people complain about, oh, I got to go a couple hours for clinical sites or I've got to do this and this. Like, I just think in my head, like, you need to listen to the stories these ladies fought to become midwives and to the stuff they went through. Like, we have it pretty
Yeah.
easy now, relatively speaking. And so
Yeah.
I
Yeah.
appreciate you sharing your story.
See the delivery of my daughter Anna was attended by two farm midwives. One was named Carol, and the other one was named Kara. And it was a pretty it was fairly funny. I hope I'm not repeating myself, but
No, we didn't get it
it
on the
was it
recording
was
the first time, so please tell that story again.
so they went out Christmas shopping, and they got stuck on the subways, so they were quite delayed, and my husband actually ended up doing the majority of my home delivery in the South Bronx while we were listening to the fire trucks and ambulances going up, and they came in at the last minute to help deliver the placenta. And it was a good thing they did, because I ended up having a retained placenta.
Yeah. Well, the point you needed the midwives, they were there for it. Your
That's right.
husband, they got what
They were there.
their time, yes.
And they
It
got
was
me
a
through my pregnancy. They got me to the point where,
Well, and things like that happen all the time. People go fast and timing, and this is why we empower our families to like just know what to do, because you never know. Even if you're planning on being at the hospital, it doesn't mean you're going to make it there and that it's going to work out how you planned. The part that really was impressive to me, Janet, before we hit recording, you were talking about some of your skills and how you practice suturing and like things we wouldn't even fathom now. But if you want to expand on that a little bit while we're recording versus beforehand.
The farm, the Plenty Project, we provided our own health care, right? So several of us developed skills that we needed to have in order to take care of each other. I had my husband and I were very good friends with a gentleman named Max Van Gilder. He was a pediatrician that knew the farm, knew the collective, and was very supportive. And he taught me how to suture. It was extremely useful, although a little bit hair-raising, some of the things that I took on as a young practitioner, suturing up somebody's hand that was severely lacerated. Fortunately, he taught me well, and the hand healed well, but I don't know whether
Yeah, I was gonna say you didn't have
somebody
to
was
worry
being
about
a
a
saint
chicken
doing
or a
that.
pig. Yeah, like we think of the stuff we practice on, and you got to practice on real life hands and in real life situations.
But he also taught me the ability to auscultate lungs so that I really knew when I heard a bronchitis, when I heard a pneumonia, and somebody was just fine, because so much of primary care, I'm sure you know, are the worried well. And how do you differentiate between someone that is the worried well, the worried well that is psychiatrically unwell,
The mental
the
aspect versus
worried
the physical,
sick person that's really sicker than crap, and that you really better get them the care that they need.
Well, and it's an art because a lot of times the test will be normal range, and maybe they have something really unique or like that intuition and trusting their body. It's more like the machine knows better than you do, and I think that's the art of midwifery, is really being able to see and hear and listen. Okay, is this that path
And
of
listen and listen and listen, because sometimes what you're doing is you're intersecting with somebody's sickness process at one stage when they really are almost well. But if you bear with them and you listen to them, you're going to be able to intervene when they're not really that well. And you really better get them antibiotics, and maybe you need to get them to the hospital, and maybe you need to make sure that they have a secure network around them. So another role that the midwives played in Tennessee in the Bronx Center is they tend to be mentors for families, because not everybody comes to the table with the same degree of emotional well-being. And there were situations where we would have families just melting down with anger, perhaps potential violence, and you would need to intervene to make sure everybody stayed healthy and well. That is actually much harder. That's
Well,
much
and I
harder.
think nowadays that skill is not taught nearly as much, or the understanding of how to support that way. And we need it more than ever. I feel like we're in that challenging where the trauma, the mental disparities are more and more, and less people have those skills to help with those needs.
And somebody can be presenting with what looks like a purely physical complaint, but it's actually where they're looking for a way to segue into care and a safe place to talk about the things nobody really wants to talk about, like the domestic violence, like the emotional violence. And those are parts of our lives. I think that it's a trick to make sure you're not taking on more than you can chew, or biting off more than you can chew, I guess is the way you should say it. There are times where you're presented with serious crises within families. On the one hand, you don't want to shut the door and deny access. On the other hand, you may need to skillfully guide them to where they're going to be able to get the kind of very careful care that they need, knowing full well they're going to come back to you again with that history, and that you're going to be somebody that was, I want to say, a fair witness to their struggle and become part of their history. Midwives have the opportunity to share lives with women in such a way that we are privileged to see the dark nights of their souls and journey with them through that, helping them have safe passage through that. That's just terrific. It's something that keeps you awake at night, too.
Yeah, we have a very oh my goodness, yes. Like I think the emotional and the pressure of what midwifery can impact, and then the like on ourselves and on the families, and what we get to see in that rare thing that the average occupation, profession, experience doesn't normally get to. It's very awe-inspiring for sure.
It is awe-inspiring, and sometimes it's keeps you up a lot at night. I mean, I had one client who would always know what night I was taking call. She always knew when I was going to be available for 24 hours, and she would always call to talk about the domestic violence within her life. And again, it was that very delicate thing of you don't want to enable somebody to not get the absolute good care they need, but you do want to be there to be that catalyst to make sure they move on to get the good care that they need.
Yeah, and that's part of that art is we sometimes get to see people in places the average healthcare provider doesn't get to with our home visits and with the guard that they put down. And okay, there's the regs, like when you think of CPS nowadays, and like I think of a lot when I do the Amish home visits, and like what is culturally like some of these situations are very difficult to process and support. Like okay, there's an educational, there's a cultural, is it true safety, like is it something that fits this line that I need to help advocate for, or just be a listening ear and kind of give some little gentle guidance to help them empower to better their life or situation. So it is very
And
challenging.
how do you keep women safe? I mean, if you have a setting where somebody is physically violent with a woman, how do you keep her safe?
Well, yeah, I mean, even thinking like safe houses and even protecting and what's, I mean, that's getting those places of mental, the funds and resources for domestic disputes and safe havens are getting less and less. And do you become that person? How much of your profession overlies? Like, yeah,
Yeah,
it's
well,
very difficult. It's difficult.
that it's very difficult. And how do you help a woman see that there's a way out, that she doesn't have to enable them, that there is another place to go, that it's kind of tricky because I remember one night when what I ended up doing, and I'm not sure whether I crossed a professional boundary here, but she needed to get away from her husband. She lived next door. She came and she banged on our door in the middle of the night, and she said, "I have my kids, I have my stuff, I need to go." So I ended up calling a contact with for the domestic violence services, and the woman and her kids got in the car with me. We took off and drove her where she connected with the organization's representative in their car and took her to a different city. And I intentionally never found out where that city was. And as it was the next day, the husband came banging on the door. Where is she? And I quite honestly said, I don't know.
Well, I think you're definitely covered by Good Samaritan on so many levels for those situations. And it is when it's your neighbor on top of your client, your person you're supporting, it's also your neighbor, your sister. You've got these other ties and relationships. I think even stepping back as midwives, sometimes just empowering who has the control. Like sometimes I think whether it's domestic violence or during labor or depression or burnout, whatever the situation, sometimes just a little bit of guidance of empowering them that they do have choices. They always have options. They may not like the next step to get to the light at the end of the tunnel, but I think sometimes just those little bit of inspirations when someone is so low in that Maslow hierarchy of needs. Just, I mean, I do it a lot with our consulting work of these ladies, these midwives are so burnt out and exhausted. And that sometimes taking a pause and a break from midwifery is better for them in the community versus just trying to chug along. And it, yeah. So I think you and I have very similar like souls of like, how do we balance that art of supporting midwives in the greater good, but also balancing that act?
I think one of the dilemmas of midwifery in this last 50 years is that we are so, when we end up in like working for doctors in a large group practice, it's really easy to get exploited. I don't know. I've had nights where I've done seven deliveries in one night. And if you're a resident and you're doing that, you go to sleep and the nurses act like you're midwives and do that work when you're a midwife. I don't know about you, but I'm there with the woman in the room, and that service is something that the doctors recognize that their patients, their customers really value, and they support us to do that. But ooh, it's so easy to get burnt out.
It is. Well, because you give and give, like you feel that guilt inside, like, well, I became a midwife and this is what I'm supposed to be. And sometimes that boundaries of self-care and we want to be in it for the long haul. Like I always try to stress midwifery isn't a sprint, it's a marathon. Like if we burn out, I mean, it was disgusting to see the latest statistics of like people choosing different professions. I think it was average 6 years, the last data I saw. And so like, how do we get midwives to maybe have a good balance of work life and raising their families and homeschooling and be able to continue saying we're having 30, 40 year experienced midwives I get to interview in the future. Like, how do we do that?
That's a really good question. And that the I remember I was at one ACNM conference, and I ended up speaking to that because I was just so full of how being exploited and not knowing how to set your boundaries, that you can't do seven deliveries a night, and that you need to push for, if you're working for a doctor's group, maybe they need to hire another midwife, and that you need to set your limits, or you're going to end up being so burned out that you don't provide good care. I've watched fellow midwives become incredibly calloused be because they were just so tired,
The
but
compassion,
still think the care
empathy.
that they were provided was better than the rote medical care.
Yeah. Well, and that's what's hard. It's like, okay, well, you're relatively better than the competition, but where we could be, and I think on both directions, the hospital midwives and the community-based midwives have their own challenges post-COVID with the huge demands and the guilt of, well, every woman deserves a home birth, every woman deserves a normal birth, and there aren't a lot of options. Like, we're in this vicious cycle, I feel like, where we don't have good clinical sites and we don't have enough midwives, and we need to like go back to the basics of the boundaries and the self-care and what is our definition of midwifery and sustainable thriving midwifery for the future versus surviving midwifery. I think the word sustainable gets a little washy to me because it means we're going to stay the same if we're lucky, and you either go up or down. You don't, nothing in life stays the same. And so I always get worried, like, how do we make thriving, successful midwifery into the next generations like it used to be?
I think that makes me think of something else that I want to have midwives embrace, is that there's different kind of clinical practices for midwives. There, I had my kids at home. I was nurtured by home birth midwives. I've always chosen to take care of the incredibly sick. And so my practice has been hospital-based, and taking the art of midwifery into that setting and making that setting safe for that severe preeclamptic who would be denied midwifery care if it all had to be a
Respecting
lower.
our colleagues, and all these variations of skill set. Because I think sometimes the community-based midwives will be like, oh, those midwives, they just want to practice medically. And I'm like, doesn't someone that's really sick with preeclampsia deserve a midwife just as much as that low-risk healthy mama does in some capacity of what we can offer? And how do we honor
Or
that?
perhaps more. And it's not just, I mean, I gave Ina May a hard time because we were at one of the conventions and there was a picture of a woman with no gloves on delivering her a baby. And this was in the time of HIV. And I said to Ina May, what are you doing? What are you doing? We don't know who's carrying HIV or not. You can't espouse less than optimally safe health care, midwifery care for women and children and midwives. Good grief. If you have a rash, a laceration, the woman has HIV and you don't know, are you then going to find yourself becoming HIV positive at another time?
And then you
Now,
share it with other ladies in the
test
community,
everybody.
and you didn't intend to, and
Yeah, we test everybody now, and I'm glad for that. That wasn't always a popular viewpoint.
Well, and
I
I think
think.
that's that merging cultures of how much medical is allowed in midwifery and where is the art of midwifery line? And I'm like, but isn't it about giving great outcomes? And sometimes we have to mix the two together once in a while. And that's what strengthens us to understand the physiology and the anatomy and the complexity of how our bodies work so that we can know those little subtle hints of variations in normal or problems.
And not be afraid of it. It's like you can open the book, you can read, you can learn, you can have mentors. You can become a very astute medical provider and midwife in one. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean the going from being a paramedic, evolving it into midwifery, the medical skills I learned as a paramedic, as a healthcare provider for the Bronx Center, for the Pliny Center, has come along with me into my midwifery. And those skills are a gift that have enriched my midwifery practice and made me able to advocate for women in a very informed fashion. I don't think we need to be afraid of learning that stuff.
No,
Yeah.
I definitely agree with you. I think about often the complexities of we already have enough barriers with healthcare and insurance reimbursement, but I think of all the different pathways of midwifery and how we aren't more of a unified front with each other and embracing each other's styles and supporting each other. It's adding to the barriers and how these are those Goliath million-dollar questions. How do you got to start somewhere, but how do you just start and get people together and bring the strengths of each person's educational
Yeah.
pathways in a more unified front.
And you're just talking about within the midwifery community. I would extend that. How do you do that within the healthcare providing community? So because we have so many silos, there's nursing, there's medicine, there's midwifery, there's nurse midwifery, there's PAs, and there tends to be too little willingness to see the continuity between all of our practice, and we throw away the jewels of being able to collaborate effectively. My husband is a physician associate. He's also an HIV specialist. I actually started on the road to HIV specialist, and then he thought, oh man, that's cool. And he joined me. So we're both HIV specialists. And our collaboration has been a gift that we've been able to extend to our patients. Because, I'm the hottest colposcopy midwife that I know. And that came from caring for women with HIV. Women with HIV tend to have severe cervical dysplasia. I think we need to embrace as much of the exciting academic skills that we can tolerate and incorporate that and make it good for women and safe for women. I think that I was moved to. I know that I was moved to learn colposcopy because I would go with my women to their colposcopy appointments after I diagnosed a bad cervical pap and watched how an unkindly placed speculum changed the whole experience when instead a little bit of being a little slick with your speculum placement, a little humorous with your discussion, you can help that perineum relax. You can get in and really see the cervix. You can make jokes when you're doing your biopsies, and they can leave finding out that, gee, it wasn't like my friend told me. That wasn't so bad. Midwifery skills teach us the value of the human connection. Midwifery skills on the farm taught the heart connection. And that heart connection is just, it's terrific. It makes you pretty tired in the middle of the night
Yeah,
when
well,
you
it's that
worry and you get
caring.
phone
Yeah,
calls
it's
and
It's that caring art. And I think more and more in healthcare, we're competing with technology driving and complicated healthcare systems, and the art of caring and the art of touch is becoming a lost art in medicine. You made me think of when we were talking about even just like anytime there's a disconnect with departments, with cultures, with people not understanding each other, it's always going back to aligning a core mission and learning from each other, shadowing from each other, seeing from each other's perspective of their strengths, their day-to-day, the impact they're doing from their angle that we make assumptions, we don't know, we don't understand. I think in general that advice can go leaps and bounds with many things in today's society, not just midwifery, but being able to understand the other person's perspective and their passion of how they view midwifery and in supporting families as a whole.
I was moved when I my journey for midwifery part of it was working at an HMO. I was hired away from the HMO at the time. It was kind of disintegrating. The HMO didn't survive managed medical competition transitions by a gentleman. His name is Vinnie Lynch. Lovely, lovely man. Taught me a lot. He's retired quite a while ago. And he watched me do what I do. Somebody had, I think it was a third degree laceration, and I had learned how to put them together. So I'm putting it together. And he was looking at my repair so closely, I thought he was going to get blood on his nose. And I looked at him at one point and I said, "Well, would you like to take over?" And he said, "Oh, no, I'm just impressed." And I said, "Good." And I finished what I was doing and he watched how I managed labors and that there was a lot less reliance on epidurals. Although I'll hold somebody for an epidural anytime, I'll help somebody out with their medications anytime. But in the end, after watching me for a while, I went up to him and I said, "Are you comfortable with what I'm doing?" And he said to me, "Oh, yes, absolutely. You've made me a better doctor."
Oh my goodness. I wish we
And
had more stories like that that were happening. Oh.
well, I think that doing what we do with informed skills, confidence, kindness, not ditching the midwifery role, and letting ourselves have collaborative friendships with our supervising physicians or whomever, we will have more of that. I think I'm being redundant here, but we need to understand that what we all want is that healthy person. And if you need their hands, good.
Yeah.
And if they need your hands, good. Let's do it. There was one gentleman who was a physician that was about, I'd say it was about 8 inches shorter than I am. So I was at that point, I was like 5'8". I've shrunken since then. And he had hands that matched his height. They were short. And there was a laceration that was way up in the sulcus. And he couldn't see what he was doing. He didn't reach the top, the apex of the laceration. And I said, "Carl, let me do this." And I depressed the perineum, whipped in some suture way up at the top, pulled down and had him retract for me so I could get the apex and then sew her up. And at that point, he understood that it's not the title of the profession, it's the competence of the provider, and became an arch supporter of me after them, because he wasn't before then. He was just terrible. He was like a little shit.
It's amazing how one little sulky chair can change someone's heart.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And you have to not be so arrogant. You don't ask for help, and you've got to not be so insecure that you can't acknowledge that you can do it better than they can.
Well, I normally end with asking for words of wisdom, but I feel like you just gave those organically. Like, that's very powerful things for the future of midwifery and that art of working as a team and showing you're confident, but
Part
also
of
not
working as a
being.
team.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't be
So,
arrogant.
yeah. 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 There's that art of educating versus like, you know what's right and everybody else is wrong. It is. It's a very difficult art, and some people are better at it than others. But yeah, Jana, I really, really appreciate your time. I think I could
I
talk to you
hope I
for
helped.
hours. Yeah, I think so. I love these conversations. We never know. We talk to young midwives, we talk to older midwives, and everybody brings their own story and strength. And I think that's what midwifery is. I always remind people it's with women. It's not not catching babies. It's not home birth, like these definitions of what we all pigeon-toe and label, like it's supporting women wherever they are. And so I appreciate all the variations of midwifery and the stories that you brought today.
If I could just say one more thing, open mind and open heart.
Yeah. We need more and more of that in life, not just in midwifery now. Yes, we do.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time today, Janet. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.